Well, welcome to another episode of The Leadership Enigma. And it's time to go a little deeper. And it's time to go a little deeper in relation to our CEO series. But we're linking this to really the conversation around money. What does it mean? It means something to all of us. What is its purpose? What is its real value? What do we do with it? Do we crave it? If so, why? Do we really need it? Well, I have so many questions, and again, like always, I have to talk to someone far wiser than myself. So come back to me just after this, where I talk to Stuart Cash, who is the co-founder and CEO of Y-Tree. Intrigued? Come back to me. Hi, I'm Adam Pacifico, and welcome to The Leadership Enigma, a world-ranked, award-winning podcast that's insatiably curious as regards what leaders do, how they do it, and importantly, why. We'll delve into the human doing, but even deeper into the human being and the power of human-centered leadership to drive sustainable change. So whether you're an entrepreneur, business owner, corporate executive, each week we speak to global experts, academics, rising stars, ambitious upstarts and disruptors, as together we will discover that success leaves clues. Stuart, it's a massive warm welcome to The Leadership Enigma. How are you?
Great. Lovely to see you.
I think I've just had a slightly intriguing intro there to you. And when I mentioned Y-Tree, probably I'm thinking, hang on, what's all that about?
Yeah.
But just tell us a little bit about you. Who is Stuart?
Who is Stuart?
Yeah, that's a good question, right?
Grew up in the leafy suburbs of northwest London in Stanmore.
You and me alike, right?
So, schooled in Elstree, educated and went into study law, Cambridge. And then dabbled a little bit in the law. I qualified and left the next day.
Another recovering lawyer.
Exactly.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
There's a real theme at the moment.
Just wasn't in it for me. And then I moved into investment banking, corporate finance. I worked in a range of different sectors. A lot of it focused on media technology, and moved out to New York actually in 1999, and switched from what was then SG Warburg to Goldman Sachs just when the market was crashing.
Right.
So that was kind of 23 years ago. Pretty similar period to how it feels now in terms of people looking at technology valuations. 23 years later, it's the same story.
I think we've gone full circle.
Yeah, amazingly.
It's strange, isn't it?
Yeah. So history repeats itself.
Let me ask you a question. I've got to ask you the question about the law. Why law in the first place, and then why not law?
You know, I was deciding what I wanted to do for a degree, and it felt like it would be really interesting to study law.
Yeah.
And then while I was studying it, thinking, you know, is this really what I want to do for a living? And I was trying to convince myself not to. Took on articles, and then
you went to a decent firm in town.
It's okay. Now called BCLP.
They're forever changing their name.
Exactly.
Aren't they?
Yeah. Okay. No, so it was good. It's a good discipline. I think it gives you structured thinking. At the time, you don't necessarily realize how it might help you.
We were young.
Yeah.
I'm using the role we there. Do you
know? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but you practiced for longer than me, I think.
Just slightly longer.
Exactly. But so, it's a great discipline, but it wasn't really for me. I felt that I wanted to, interestingly, know why things were happening rather than actually implement them.
Right.
And by moving into investment banking, I had the chance to understand why companies were doing things, why they were valued in a certain way, why company A was buying company B, and to really understand more about how the economy fits together with different sectors. So that was more interesting than getting the deal done for me.
So that's interesting. So when you kind of quit the law and moved into investment banking, was that born of curiosity, do you think, or interest in the financial side of things? Because I would run a mile from the financial side of things.
Yeah.
There's a reason that I did law. That's because I was rubbish at maths. But for you, what was the draw maybe to investment banking?
I thought it was a really fascinating industry. You could just learn about new industries. You could learn about existing industries and understand how things fit together. And that kind of drives my passion to really get to the bottom of why things happen.
Right.
What's the motivation behind them?
Where's that come from then?
I'm just a curious person, I think, really. I think lots of stuff comes from your family. I think my parents are curious people and driven people, and lots of my values come from them.
Okay.
So I think my schooling was like that. You know, I was at a school that was kind of, for me, enjoyable, challenging, but for some it was kind of quite quite difficult. And I, at the time, I just enjoyed
it. It's in Elstree. It's probably the same school that my wife went to.
Right, exactly.
The boys and the girls school. That's
and,
right.
And there was like an electric gate between the
there
two.
There was. We're talking about the same place, yeah.
Exactly. So for me, it was a kind of bit of a sink or swim environment there. You were really told like...
It's quite a high-pressure environment.
Definitely. But I think I enjoyed that. Okay. It really appealed to my
character. Not for everyone.
No, I think I realised that afterwards. There were friends of mine who said they really hated their time there. And yeah. For me, it was...
Which is a shame, isn't it? When you're that young and spend so much time.
Yeah.
Let's see. That's interesting, isn't it? So investment banking, was it what you thought it would be or hoped it would be? And if so, how fast was it for you in relation to, okay, I found my place?
It's a really exciting environment to be in when you're young and you're learning, because you get to meet with business leaders really early on.
Yeah.
And so for me, sitting in a room with a chairman or CEO when you're in your mid-20s, and it's you, and at that time an MD, and you're kind of quite into just doing everyone else's job instead of waiting to... you know, pick up the mantle from the next partner that retires in a law firm. For me, it was really interesting that I could just find a way to advise, understand things, and be part of a discussion that was quite high level.
Was it greater opportunity sooner within that sector than it was perhaps if you're thinking of the life within a law firm?
Definitely more experience, definitely more exposure, definitely the chance to talk with more senior executives, understand what drives them.
Yeah.
With lawyers, you would work with them, but of course they'd get involved later on around the transaction.
So that's interesting. So it's interesting you've got that ability to compare and contrast. Listen, I want to ask you, because obviously you spent some time in New York, but actually you were in New York, weren't you, for 9/11?
I was, actually.
So that's a real personal experience. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I was actually underneath the first tower when the plane went in.
Wow.
In a yellow cab. Driving down to Goldman Sachs in near Wall Street, and I remember it sounded a bit like sonic boom, of an aircraft, which I thought was probably just like a light aircraft going into, you couldn't even see from that vantage point, into the building, and then.
But it was obviously something had happened.
Something happened. People were screaming. You could kind of see shards of glass and you know, papers falling.
That's about as close as you probably want to be, isn't it?
Yeah, but I remember then going to whatever it was, I think it was the 16th floor at Goldman, and right next to my little office was a TV room, and we were all watching the TV, and no one knew what had happened, because the first plane, if you recall, people had no idea what was going on. When the second plane went in, that's when everyone said, there's something really serious going on. So it's a pretty scary time. I remember being in the building when the towers went down, and even on the 16th floor, it was pitch dark. At about whatever it was, 10:30 in the morning, 11 o'clock in the morning.
Wow, just from the dust and the rubble.
Yeah, and then walked home after that. So I was lucky not to get caught in the whole all of the dust clouds.
Because that's having a huge impact on so many lives, and continues to have an impact, even though you know, the many who lost their lives on the day.
Yeah,
what kind of impact did that have on you, being so close to something that changed the world?
Yeah, I think. The really interesting thing was looking at New York as a city that is quite renowned for being a bit frenetic.
Yeah.
And so seeing New Yorkers dealing with that adversity was quite interesting. People really came together. You know, you had firemen that were hugging people on that day. People were really coming together, thinking about what was the impact on their lives. People were trying to search for people. They didn't know where they were.
Right.
You'd be walking around downtown New York, and there were photos everywhere in every coffee shop. Every shop had lines of photos looking for people.
Right.
And so it kind of brought the city really together.
Did you stay in the city after it happened as well, or did you end up coming back to the UK?
Well, we were living at the time in Tribeca, which is, I think it was like 11 blocks away from Ground Zero.
Yes.
At night, you could smell the smoke coming from Ground Zero because it was still smoking for a long time.
Wow.
And you heard the lorries going by. Taking away the rubble down the streets, so it was a really harrowing time.
I'm hoping at some point that one of the chief fire officers actually is coming on the show.
Really?
He dealt with 9/11, so it's you know, I hope you don't mind me asking about that, because you know, there are so many things that shape us and have an impact on us. One of the reasons, actually, and this is where I put two and two and come up with five, is you know, you talk very much about the people impact and the human impact. Yeah. It's undeniable with that. But you're quite people and human focused as well. Yeah. And I want to talk a little bit about you, the essence of you, before I go on to what you founded and the role that you have at the moment as CEO and what that's doing. But, you know, think about the experiences that you've had through school, the law, the investment banking, 9/11, other things that have happened to you. Did you have a sense of the kind of leader that you would be before you started Y-Tree?
No.
Okay.
No, I don't think so. I think I've discovered more in the role. I think when I look back, you can look at someone's career and you can think, well, they were a real success.
Right.
Because you can look from the outside and say, well, you know, they became a partner of Goldman Sachs. It looks like you've reached the pinnacle of the investment banking community.
On paper, right?
Yeah, it's exactly. And I've never really wanted to define myself by my title or my role. I don't like to go out and dine out on it, if you like.
Yeah.
But I think when I look back to my career, it was full of times where I was digging deep. So I think of being a very resilient person. But I look at it when I was in my childhood, you know, my part of my when I was at school. I remember being predicted 2 C's and a D for my A levels,
right?
And thinking, well, maybe I just don't want to go to university. And I think that made me dig deep and try and pull it out of the bag. I, you know, ended up doing pretty well. I remember when I was at Cambridge in my first year, I was playing lots of sport,
right?
And couldn't really play more than half time football. Beyond half time, because I had so much pain in my back, I went to see a specialist.
Right.
Who gave me an injection to put anti-inflammatories in my back.
Yes.
I ended up with a lumbar puncture, which is something you get when you've when you're at that time giving birth. But that for me meant I couldn't work my second term, but I did okay in that. And I think it's those kinds of things that I think mark you as a leader. I think it's really interesting today, especially when we think about generational differences between my generation, Gen X, Gen Z, and people's approach to how they think about career, life, dealing with setbacks.
Especially when you're having to manage and lead
multi-generations.
Really,
so I think resilience is really important.
Where'd that resilience come from?
Definitely my parents.
Tell me more.
Well, I think they've got a very positive attitude to life.
Right.
I've got two siblings. My sister's a physio. My brother's works in a tech business doing voice recognition tech, but he's cerebral palsy.
Right.
And so growing up, the three of us, with a younger brother who's handicapped, you know, really smart guy, but physically handicapped.
Yes.
We never really thought of him as a different person in our family, as a handicapped person. And
right.
My parents always had that sense of, if things aren't going well, dust yourself down and move on. And we treated my brother as just a regular person in the family.
Okay.
And they had that attitude towards him, which is just be like everyone else, you know, drive a car, ski, if you can ski, which he does. And he's been doing a sales job for a while. Those kinds of things make you look at someone else and think, well, if they're...
It's quite inspiring.
It's quite inspiring. And I think he has that impact on people. So that I think that attitude of whatever adversity you've got, deal with it and keep going, is definitely something I got from my parents.
And this is why I'm always fascinated with these conversations, because, you know, we start to dig into the human being over the human doing. You've already achieved a huge amount, and we're going to come on to what you're doing right now, but I'm always fascinated by the being side of things. What have you experienced, and what's been the impact on you? I want to talk a little bit about what you're doing now.
Yeah.
But just to tell us, at what point, because it was three of you who decided to co-found Y-Tree, and I think you're an eclectic mix, aren't you,
in
some ways? You've got the complete skill set between you.
Right.
But just tell us when and how you decided that you were going to start your own business, which is now over 160 people strong, so that's some going. But when was it?
Well, I was at Goldman in 2014, 2015.
Right.
I was running a business that was doing asset liability management for pension funds.
Okay. See, that's why I did law, Stuart.
Exactly. Well, you know, it was much better being... tell you what, it was better being a tech banker. much better, you know, dinner party conversation than saying, I'm a pensions advisor. But no insult to people who advise people
on
pensions. But I did it for a while. I would just say that it's a really interesting area which impacts the whole economy.
Yeah.
Pensions basically getting salary for the rest of your life. The old-fashioned defined benefit pension means that when you've got some of these large employers like ICI and Boots and WH Smith and Lloyds Bank, basically you've got your current workforce, they get paid, and then you've got your former workforce that's getting paid salary with inflation for the rest of their lives. And then there's often a spouse pension, which is 50% of the original. So dealing with that problem was a big thing.
Those older pensions, those final salaries.
Gilt-edged.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Especially in the public sector.
Yes.
Because obviously, as you know, I spent some time within the police, and those were final salary, gilt-edged in many ways.
Yeah.
But don't get me wrong, you certainly have to work for it.
Yeah.
But
it's an amazing value.
Yes.
So we were dealing with that.
Right.
So-called assets sitting in the pension trust, liabilities effectively paying the pensions.
Yeah.
And I was interested to see that people had the same problem in their lives. So if you think about people who don't have a gilt-edged pension, basically you go through the first part of your life when you are being paid for by your parents. They pay for your food and your clothing and holidays and going out and school and all that. Hopefully, yeah. And then you go through a period when, after education, you hopefully earn some money. You hopefully can save some money. If you save some money, you're building up savings, capital, house maybe, mortgage. And then you're building more capital, hopefully, over your life until you get to a point where you either don't want to work or you can't work.
Yes.
And hopefully you can keep up a similar standard of living. And that's asset liability management. People now talk about the 100-year life rather than, you know, 60 or 65 years. And that means you need your money to go a long way.
That's quite frightening in some ways, isn't it? I was thinking to myself, my word, I may have got this all wrong.
but that
is quite a frightening prospect.
Yeah. So large part, if you think about it, even from a society point of view, the fact that large numbers of people will be living post-work in so-called retirement, probably with better health because we've looked after ourselves and better medication, it's quite a big impact on society.
And the demographics of some countries probably may create even more problems. Hasn't China got a demographic where they're going to have way more people now coming through middle age into the latter part and probably not enough of a younger population to be able to sustain it? So I'm not sure how that works. So
no, it's difficult, challenging.
So you were fascinated about this. So tell me how you kind of met your co-founders and you branched into the idea of Y-Tree. I think I've just done a pun without it meaning to, but tell us a little bit about that. How you met and you know together you thought, I know, let's do Y-Tree, and then we can talk about what it is.
Interestingly, we were all kind of rowing our own boats.
Yep.
I was looking to help people who worked in large companies engage with their money. I realized people didn't understand that they needed to save.
Yes.
So I was working with a few relatively well-known employers in the UK about giving their employees money in the palm of their hand, seeing everything, seeing how you could compound it over time. I was doing that for about a year, thinking about how I would do that. And then I met with Eric Peretz.
He's the tech chap, right?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. He's a really interesting entrepreneurial guy. We met on a dog walk on Hampstead Heath. Very serendipitous.
Where else would you in Northwest London, right?
Exactly. I was being sort of my typical cheeky self because he spoke to his dog in Hebrew and said, Boena, which means come here.
Right.
And I said, oh, your dog speaks Hebrew. And that's literally how we met. And so we just started chatting about what he was doing. He was building a challenger bank.
Right.
Try to work out if you could build something that was going to take on the big banks.
Today. Be a disruptor.
Exactly.
Right.
I was building more of a long-term savings kind of business about where your money was going to take you over time. So we put our heads together and talked about life and walked on the heath
with
the dogs.
Having met on the park. Isn't this crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, amazing. And he brings with him, you know, really good understanding of how to grow businesses from scratch.
Yeah.
You know, I'd always been working in some blue chip organizations with large companies, advising big corporate clients. He brought with him really good understanding of how to be a scrappy entrepreneur, do it in what he calls a low risk way, which people might think, explain to me what's low risk entrepreneurship.
Depends on the individual, maybe.
And so it was a really good mix from, you know, technology, digital product with my understanding of corp finance and complex advice.
Yes.
And then we then met with Johnny Hample, who had actually been a real lawyer because he worked at, you know, a well-known law firm for about 6 years. And then he was building...
He's now another recovering lawyer.
Right, exactly, exactly. So he actually spent 2 years at Goldman, but we didn't meet then.
Oh, wow.
Working with private clients.
Yeah.
But then he went to Partners Capital, which is really an outsourced chief investment office that started with wealthy individuals running the big private equity firms.
Right.
And some of the hedge funds. And then they moved into foundations and colleges. And he brought with him a really good understanding of people. He's an amazing relationship person.
Right.
Earns trust really fast and really wants to do the right thing by the individual.
Okay.
And so it was a great, it was a really, obviously he understands investment really well. He's very passionate about that. So it was a really good blend of skills to roll up into, you know, creating three people founding a business.
So help us understand, what is Y-Tree?
Y-Tree is a business that sits on top of the wealth management industry. We're a new category in personal financial services. You can think of us as giving you a service that creates transparency over all of your financial services providers. So it could be a clearing bank, or it could be a wealth manager, it could be an IFA, it could be a mortgage provider. At some point, it might become an insurance company that we'd sit over. So we're looking at all of that, aggregating everything, giving you real transparency. The other thing that we found is people don't really understand what's going on across their financial affairs. It's quite complex, even for people who are former colleagues of mine in financial services.
Right.
So giving people that understanding is really important. That's the second thing that we do. And then the third thing is that the industry is quite opaque. People don't really see what they're being charged. They don't really see where there's value being created. So we create a lot of efficiency, a lot of value creation that the industry leaves on the table. Or sometimes, you know, it's fees that you kind of need to reduce. So really, for us, a business that's creating transparency, real meaning or understanding, and real efficiency for people's financial services.
And was it one of you that landed on this as the business of choice, or was it a collective where you just discussed it and it
it's kind of funny, these things are organic. I was building this sort of long-term asset liability management business for humans. Eric was building sort of near-term experiences around your money. Johnny wanted to build something that was really transparent and efficient for people to manage their money, so investments. And we put our ideas together and said, you know, this is what we're going to build.
Right.
So when we're kind of almost the opposite of the industry, because we don't charge for assets under management. We just charge for advice, insight. And so the industry charges for the products.
Okay.
We charge for the insight.
So how do you, where's the data coming from? Are you being able to tap into other systems, or how, because obviously you want the data in order to create the insight.
Yeah.
How are you gathering that data?
We collect it.
Right.
Using a whole range of different technologies.
Yeah.
Some that start manual and become completely automated, but you know, we've integrated now with over 40 of the world's largest wealth managers. So when someone comes along that is working with a provider that we don't integrate with, then that just becomes another chance to build the next integration.
And they're all happy for that integration to take place. What's the benefit for them?
Well, for the client, it's great.
Yeah.
To be honest, I think that most private banks, wealth managers would love to provide an integration service.
Right.
They generally don't see the whole balance sheet for their clients.
Yeah.
So coming in independently as a non-product provider gave us quite an interesting way to build that transparency. So at some point, it may be something we provide to the industry, but it's not something that they normally provide themselves today.
When we talk about wealth management and sometimes global wealth management, we're actually talking about high net worths. And is that a category that creates its own nuance or challenge itself when dealing with high net worth individuals?
Definitely the needs. I mean, one of my discoveries, sadly, when I started looking into could we build an asset liability management business for humans, was there is a small proportion of the population that actually uses wealth management. I mean, 1% of the wealth of the world by number is over 50% of the wealth.
Yeah, that's kind of scary, isn't it, when you
Very.
Say that out loud. So 1% is 50% of the global wealth.
Yeah. It's probably greater now after inflation over the last few years.
Yes.
It's really startling. Originally, I was doing research in supermarkets because that was,
yeah.
at that point, potentially a client base I was going to work with, was people working for supermarkets. And it's quite harrowing sitting on the shop floor, listening to people talk about money, because most people in that, so let's say 80-90% of the population are thinking about how will they last through the next pay packet.
It's critical at the moment in the current climate.
And that's not wealth management. That's expense management, and it's debt consolidation and cost reduction.
Yes.
It's not about wealth management.
So really you're operating for the 1%.
We're operating probably for the top 5% ultimately, but yes. right now we're in the top 1%. And there are 600,000 people out of 66 million that have got more than £1 million in the UK. That's the top 1%.
I find the whole thing quite startling, actually, I'm doing another podcast. Actually, I'm hoping sooner rather than later we're looking at really the meaning of money. Mm. But tell me a little about your thoughts about what are you doing this? What is it you want people to achieve? What does money do for people? What's the you talked about bringing money to life or turning money into life. Help us understand that thinking, that mantra.
We think of money as the enabler,
right?
Experiences, life experiences. Money's there to be spent. So if you flip the whole concept of wealth management is to think of it as spending.
Yes.
That's really what we're focused on. That's where our purpose starts with the client.
They say you can't take it with you.
Yeah.
The old adage, but...
That's right. But it's really about sitting down with a family.
Yes.
Being really inclusive about what the family wants to spend their money on, whether it's on them as a couple or whether it's their children or whether they're things they're interested in society, whether it's education, whether it might be the next generation, whether it's charitable, whether it's their parents to give back. For these people, it's really interesting for them to start to think about what their money can do for them. And then, interestingly, to have the confidence to know they can afford to do the things that they aspire to. It's an amazing thing how...
It's quite personal, isn't it, for people? Because, I mean, let's be honest with you, that's not just a British thing. People don't tend to like to talk about money. Yeah. So are you gathering any insights as you're talking to people with resources, with finances, when it comes to talking about, what is it you want to experience in life through the money? What is the legacy that you want to create or provide?
Yeah.
As opposed to just what's the next vehicle you want to buy or something,
Exactly.
Are you getting some insights or some aha moments as you're having these conversations with the 1%?
For sure. One really interesting, there's so much psychology around money.
Right, I bet.
And I'm sure you'll have experienced as you went through your career and you earn a little bit more, you'd spend a little bit more, right? We all do that, I think. And then, of course, you go through tough times, you might spend a little bit less. But I think generally as people accumulate more and they earn more, they spend more, and then their lifestyle grows. And so it's really interesting to see people that have more money also having similar, obviously, what you might call first world problems, thinking about what would I do with my money?
Right.
And so that psychology of how much is enough is really interesting. And then...
Do you think people should know that? Because otherwise, when do you ever win? Or is it... Because there are many people out there who just keep chasing and chasing and chasing.
Sure.
And so, how many yachts and how many houses and how many cars?
Yeah.
And that can be relentless. I always think that's... Maybe that's my excuse for not having a yacht. I don't know. But I always think... I wonder whether that's incredibly tiring and debilitating where you just don't know when you've won.
Yeah.
Is that even a thing?
I think everyone's got different
right.
psychology around it. I think I wouldn't want to take away from people their desire to have another house or have another,
of course.
Something like a yacht or a car. That's fine. And also in their daily lives and work, the next deal and making more money from the next deal, that's something that does drive people. So I don't think there's anything wrong with having that ambition, that passion, that drive. But to get philosophical about it, when you think about people that leave legacy,
yes,
it's not really, a lot of the time, the legacy isn't about the money, it's about the values that they pass down. When you think of leaders that passed down values. Often some of them can be young, like Martin Luther King or John F. Kennedy,
yes.
People who passed down values. Even if you go back biblically, you think about shepherds who left values that still exist today. Didn't have much money to pass on values that we talk about.
Well, this is kind of takes me to, you know, when we first talked, there's this fascinating discussion, isn't it, that we're going to have, I hope now, is about value and values.
Yeah.
Because I think if people think about wealth,
yeah,
and wealth creation, they think about what is the value that I have and
yeah,
what maybe does that buy from a value proposition. But you're talking, yeah, about values.
Yeah.
And I know you've really thought about this, and this is perhaps part of your DNA as a CEO. And, you know, with over 160 people within, this will be part and parcel of who you are as an organization.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about your thinking about this whole aspect of value and values.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts?
Well, I'm going to go to values, I think,
mm-hmm,
because we care about them a lot at Whytree. And I think when we hire people, I'm realizing more and more we hire for their competence, technical skills and experience. But the most important thing is their mindset, their values. That's the thing that really drives the organization. You can't, yeah, build a business unless you've got great people.
Is that competence almost table stakes? And then once the table stakes, yeah, are in place, you're really looking for what you think really kicks, yeah, in, and that's the value piece, the culture, yeah, piece.
And I think I look back on my career and I think about some really smart people I work with.
Yeah.
But I think the differentiating factor of what has an impact in an organization is normally the behaviors, not the smarts. There's many smart people around, but I think we look at the people we really think can impact the organization. It's how they work with others.
Yeah.
It's the impact they can have, and that's driven by the way they behave. So we've brought in three values at Whytree.
Yeah, tell us about those. I've got them in front of me, but let me
get
you to say them.
We think the essence of our business is time.
Tell me more.
In a business where compounding has a really big impact.
Yes.
Starting earlier.
Earlier,
means
the better.
The better, yeah. And that means that if you're just saving 0.5% or 1% or compounding a little bit more value,
yes,
of 0.5% or 1%, it's massive over time. So that's the essence of our business. But we also want to give people time in our business because they want to spend the time with their family and their friends and doing the things they value in life. And so when we think about our business, it's the essence of our service is to give people more time, quality time. And then it pervades into the way we think about how we are with ourselves. So right, being generous with our time to give to our colleagues so they understand more about our business as they're coming on board. So training them, being respectful of someone's time, being responsive. It's all part of the culture that we want to build that will enable us to be the same between ourselves and our clients so that we keep that same thought process.
I'm racking my brain, Stuart, as you're explaining that, to think, is there another business I've worked with where time was one of their values? And I can't at the moment.
Yeah.
So that's really quite unique to
it's
you.
It's really interesting.
And it's interesting to hear how you explain it, the narrative behind it. So yeah, time is the first one.
But also, by the way, being succinct, you know, really being respectful when you're with a client, that you're going to give them an answer that's not overly complicated, but just gives them the essence. It's a real art. I think it's a real mark of a great advisory business to give succinct advice. That's time. So
maybe what we weren't taught when we were lawyers.
Maybe, yeah. So
that's the time one.
Yeah. The togetherness one.
Yep.
I think it's about creating a high-performing team. It's about caring for each other. It's,
yep,
about being really open. It's about making feedback a really critical part of the culture. Probably the core, because I my experience, until we brought in a really interesting way to give feedback into our organization, is that you get your annual review. That's
right,
pretty normal for a large
that
organization.
One time in the year.
Yeah, you get scored.
Yeah, God.
I think it's still the same pretty much in most organizations today.
It is.
You get scored. You
surprise.
You sit there.
I know, yeah.
You get all the positive attributes. Then you get your developmental points.
And then
your head's in a spin.
Couldn't you not have told me that 7 months ago? So yeah, I could have done something about it. So
And then you think, well, what am I going to do with it? So for us, feedback is about continuously trying to help people, seeing feedback as a gift. That's really a big part of togetherness.
I always love it when people say that, because it's the one gift that no one really wants.
Yeah.
Because of the way it's done.
It's the hardest thing to do.
I'm with you.
So that's, to us, that is the concept of really trying to help us be the best that we can be,
right,
for ourselves and for the business. That's the togetherness. The responsibility part we actually brought in recently. That to me is all about clarity of execution,
right.
Clarity of who is going to drive processes, and also realizing that when you're leading, you don't have to be doing. As in, if you're a facilitative, collaborative leader,
yes,
then your job is to bring the collective thoughts of the organization to be really clear about what you want, and to make sure that you're engaging people in giving you thoughts, challenges. It's a difficult thing to do, but I think I always feel upset if I have a meeting and I don't get any comments.
So do you, when you look at these values of time together and the responsibility, do you in some ways see how all of these are anchored in you, who you are, the DNA that you have, the experiences that you have?
I think they are, because I wouldn't be comfortable with them, because
yes.
It needs to be authentic. I do think, though, it's a real reflection of the three founders. I think culture comes, it's amazing how culture in a business and values come from the personality of the founders.
Right.
And we spent time. So I do think it's a reflection of the three of us, and definitely the organization, the brand is a reflection.
When did that start to happen for you as the three co-founders? Because I'm sure when you probably started the business and it's all hands to the pump and
yeah.
all hell is breaking loose and you are getting the first people through the door. When, at what point did you start to become deliberate about, hang on, we really need to think about our culture.
Yeah.
We need to think about values, and we need to think about the human being side of those who are coming and doing things for us. When did that become deliberate?
Early 2021. Did a couple of things.
Just coming out of the pandemic, weren't we?
Yeah.
Well, no, we were still going, really, in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of the next wave, if you like. I say it was then. First of all, we started actually to take exec coaching into our business then.
Okay.
And we realized that because we were going to grow quite substantially as a business,
yes.
that a lot of us might need some help thinking about how we grow culturally as an organization and to give people some tools to be able to use to grow
yep.
teams. And so that was probably one of the best things we did, actually, was hiring coaches for the three of us and then for our team leaders, because we have a group of about 13 of us now, including...
Right. Is that the management team or the
leadership
team?
Yeah, we call it team leaders.
Yeah.
And so that's across all the areas of the business.
Right.
And that enables us to grow as a group, to be more candid as a group,
yeah.
to understand how to operate more effectively and communicate more effectively, and to deal with more challenging situations in a really constructive way. But it also enabled us to think about how we grew as individuals and understand each other.
Yeah.
Thinking about what's in the other person's head rather than your own head.
So what type of CEO do you think you're becoming? Because you're learning and you're working.
Definitely.
We're all work in progress, and you've
yeah,
talked about having a coach. So
yeah.
I'm not asking the question of what kind of CEO are you. In some ways, I'm saying what kind of CEO are you growing into, do you think, as part and parcel of your journey?
So for me, candor is really important.
Right.
I like to... be able to say what I think. I like to be really open with people, sometimes even alarmingly open, but
right.
just say it the way it is. Don't really
like
it. Well,
it's bordering on radical candor?
Well, maybe not in the sort of Ray Dalio context,
yeah.
the same way of that radical transparency and let's review each other at the end of the meeting, and not quite. I may get there actually at some point. But personally, I feel comfortable when I can tell people
yeah.
what I'm thinking and not hold stuff back. It's a really interesting...
And vice versa, for people to tell you exactly what they're thinking?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, how are you going to develop self-awareness? How are you going to grow? It's just
yeah.
impossible. So we are works in progress.
Always.
It's one of the most difficult things to be able to obtain feedback on yourself. So you have to make yourself vulnerable.
Yes.
And I've found... A few things I found in my journey in this sort of the last few years. First of all, I found that talking about what you're working on as a person
yeah.
is really empowering for the group, because they suddenly see there's someone who's happy to be open about the fact that there are things they need to improve on. And then they start to realize, well, they're not perfect. None of us are perfect. So that's a good thing. And it means you can
yeah.
be comfortable and not feel like you have to be this this facade. There's no reason to have that. It just makes you feel actually more impactful if you're open, rather than try and put up some mask that I think you've talked about before.
Well, that's interesting, because you mentioned that you listened to Tim Kresick's episode,
yeah,
which was, he's the CEO of Vorboss.
Yeah.
And again, a fairly young CEO who, you know, describes himself how he saw almost overnight great success.
Yeah.
He hasn't changed, but maybe how he's perceived has changed.
Yeah.
But he's also talked about how the human being and human doing, he can't detach them. Now, you've come from some traditional businesses, law and investment banking, where in, let's remember it now, and sometimes the 80s and 90s, where it was leave your baggage at the door, leave your personal stuff at the door and get on and do things. What's your view, though, as a leader and a leader of people in relation to sometimes life just doesn't work properly and we have challenges and...
Yeah.
Do we separate? Do we just? Is it who we are? What are your thoughts in relation to people at work on a deeply human level?
That's a really, really interesting question. So, I mean, I think first of all, we have lots of people that are dealing with adversity all the time. You know, it could be health,
yeah.
It can be relationships, and it is challenging for them sometimes to come into work. We know that.
Yes.
We really want them to talk about it and see if we can help them.
Yeah.
So I think you have to be understanding and human as an organization. But I would say that I try when I'm dealing with things in my life, because we all deal with them.
Of course.
I try not to bring it into work, and it's difficult, but I try to go to work, focus on what I'm doing at work, and then when I'm not at work. Because I think you...
But you're there for other people, though, aren't you? Anyone can come to you, and as the CEO,
100%.
I'm assuming they can come to you and say, listen, I'm struggling with X, or I need a bit of time for Y. So you've got them. Who's got you?
Well, I think that's where I feel my business partners really help me.
Okay.
I mean, there's my family, but I feel that I do feel that I can talk with them about things, because I want them to understand where I'm at and things that could have happened, you know, over the weekend or during the week. I think it's really important that you can be open, because then there's nothing to hide.
Right.
And it enables you just to be... just more natural in the way you're interacting. But interesting though, I don't believe in work-life balance. And I say
I had another CEO that doesn't exist.
Well, the reason I say it is because I think it's life balance. So, and that's another thing I think it's interesting for us to think about as a business and then bring to the outside world. If you're in a place where you obviously are in a job that you enjoy, and you're good at it, and you can get paid enough for it, and it's purposeful in the world.
With the purpose piece, isn't it?
Yeah, then I think you're in a great spot. That's the Japanese ikigai concept, I think. But not everybody has that privilege. But I think we're all aspiring, if we can, to do something that we feel is purposeful, and we enjoy, and we're good at, and we get paid enough. That's a great place to be.
And highly relevant if you're trying to attract younger talent and retain them.
Absolutely.
This is a huge piece of the puzzle, isn't it?
Sure. Sure. So I think having that purpose definitely gives us meaning. It gives our people meaning.
Yeah.
And I think it just rubs off when you're with clients. So my concept of life balance, and it's a little bit privileged to say it, so I kind of hesitate to some extent, but if you're working 9 to 5, and most of us work a lot longer than 9 to 5.
Yeah.
Let's say 8 to 6. Let's say 8 to 8. It's a very large part of your life. If you don't enjoy it, try not to do it. Go and do something that you will enjoy. Now, I say that, it's a little easy to say that when I think I've got to the part of my life, my career, when I'm really doing something I'm enjoying and I feel like it's purposeful.
Well, we're getting into a more philosophical conversation almost, aren't we, in relation to that element. And in some ways, everyone's looking for that sweet spot as regards what we do during the day and much out there in relation to purpose. I'm intrigued, three of you co-founded the business. You're the CEO.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
I think we've all naturally gravitated to the roles that we are our strengths. I think it's a good thing to focus on strengths. So there's many things that I'm not good at. And that's what Johnny and Eric are good at. Johnny's amazing with people and clients and earning trust.
Right.
I can do that, but not in the way Johnny does that. He's
right person for the right job, right
very,
time.
Very unusual and very talented. And
he's
also deeply analytical when it comes to numbers, even though he was a lawyer.
Right.
And And Arik's really good at breaking down processes and working out what am I going to do tomorrow, and obviously understands technology and digital product processes deeply. And we've also got very different personalities. And so mine naturally is, you know, fit in the middle is culture, it is strategy, it's marketing, it's our finances, it's relationship with shareholders. And I think, so we're all playing to our strengths, which is a really, it's a lovely thing.
Actually. Next week's episode is Nick Johnson, who specialised in executive loneliness. He wrote a book on executive loneliness. Have you found it a little bit lonely as the CEO, or have you been, again, deliberate in relation to... In some ways, again, I come back to this piece about vulnerability, understanding, Stuart, what your needs are, and then having the confidence to go and ask other people to help you with those needs.
Yeah.
How have you operated?
Well, it's interesting. I was running on my own steam at first, as I said, all three of us were doing our own thing. Yep. And I did find that quite difficult.
Yeah.
And so in that period, I was definitely looking for a running mate or running mates. I wanted to have
serendipity.
Yeah.
Hampstead Heath.
Yeah, absolutely. But it really, I felt I needed to have someone that I could bounce ideas off who was going to have contrasting experience.
Yeah.
And actually very different way of thinking about the world. I mean, I think of diversity, not just about gender, sexuality. I think about different brains thinking in different ways.
Diversity of thought.
Yeah. And it, for me, you know, sometimes when you see us in action, we're in very heated debate.
Yes.
We try and, you know, measure that. But I've realized more and more that the time when you experience challenge is the time when you're experiencing growth.
Yes.
And it feels...
Might not feel like it at the time. It
feels really difficult.
Like we always say, we'll laugh about this one day, just not just now.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And it's when you're in those moments, if you can actually realize this is where the growth's happening.
Yes.
Because you're that challenged.
That self-awareness.
Yeah.
Early self-awareness.
Yeah. And it happens a lot. If you get challenged and you're in a meeting and it's totally... putting you off of your train of thought and you feel like, especially with ego, I think it's an interesting thing for leaders to think, I'm the person who needs to be right in the room. Well, actually, if you suspend your thought and think, actually,
ego-less.
Your job is to listen and then be able to bring the most out of people. It's so much more rewarding than thinking you need to be the person with all the right
and
answers.
And have those very smart people surrounding you, for sure.
Yeah, sure.
What's the legacy for Y-Tree? What are you hoping to achieve?
Well, if we hit our mission...
Yes.
Our vision.
Yeah.
Then we'll be making people more conscious around what their money can do for them, especially if we can do it with the top 1%. I do feel that their impact
and influence is huge.
Will be greater on society.
Right.
So I think that will be our legacy, and it's quite difficult. You know, it's a very, very large industry. Wealth management, which we sit on top of. And so to try to transform an industry like that is quite a challenging thing. But for us, we feel like we're doing the right thing.
How do people get in touch with either you or Y-Tree if they want to learn more or they want to join in the conversation, or people say, I would like Stuart to come and talk to me in relation to X, Y, and Z? I mean, what's the best way, Stuart?
Well, we've got a website.
Let's give us the URL and we'll put that into the show notes as well.
We're Y-Tree.
Okay.
.com. So why the letter and tree as in
tree.
Trees in the forest.
There we go.
With a tall tree.
As simple as that.
In a big forest.
We'll put that in there. Yeah. Listen, thanks so much for taking the time to come into the studio and share some of your thinking around these. I really appreciate it. I hope this has been,
it's been fun
for you as well.
Great. Yeah, really
in relation to it. And you like the new studio?
I think
I
it's great.
I'm asking people
it's,
that,
it's,
right?
It's techie. I think it's very techie.
It's very.
It's kind of neon.
Well, we've gone for blue. That's our colour.
It's a bit nightclubby, I think.
Is it?
Don't you think?
It's a bit nightclubby, James. He's not even listening.
I think you can have a few martinis on the side here.
Well, can I say, when they do some of the evening pods, there has been the odd alcoholic beverage.
Exactly. I can imagine that.
On the desk.
You just
so
need
this
to have
is the
a,
scene of many pods.
Some great, you know, speakers here pumping the music, we feel right.
It would be great. Listen, thanks so much for coming in. I really appreciate it. All right.
Cheers, thanks.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Join us again next week for more Curiosity and Insight with the Leadership Enigma. We'd love to hear your comments on today's show, as well as suggestions for future topics and guests. Get in touch with me on LinkedIn or visit us at www.leadersenigma.com. Don't forget to rate, review and subscribe on all your major podcast platforms and on our dedicated YouTube channel. Thanks again for joining the community.